Asia Chat Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion of hottest topics in Central Asia and soon the Caucasus, with your hosts Aygerim Toluhanova and
Alisher Hamidov, a journalist based in Bishkek.
For this episode, we will discuss the topic of language issue in Kazakhstan and see how the situation is in Kyrgyzstan, also the ongoing developments on border delimitation between Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and what led to arrests of dozens of activists last week in Kyrgyzstan, and also the pressure on independent media outlets. As a bonus, we have an exclusive interview with extremism expert Nurbek Bekmurzaev, who spoke to our Central Asia editor Peter Leonard. But let's get back to the language issue. Language is a sensitive and political issue in Kazakhstan, and this past week it has proven to be the case once again. Last week, one entrepreneur, his name is Ramil Mukharyapov, he is ethnic Tatar and co-founder of online services company Choco Family, has caused public outcry with his statements about the use of Kazakh language. He was at the meeting with Russian migrants who recently fled Russia to avoid mobilization there in Kazakhstan, and I think it was in Almaty. And there he said that he was like given some instructions on how to live in Kazakhstan, and he said that those people who reply to their question, which was asked in Russian back in Kazakh language while knowing Russian language, are doing so hardly out of high culture. It caused a lot of outcry in Kazakhstan, and there have been plenty of angry posts on social media about it. Even some people protested in front of his company's office. Yeah, a lot of people were saying that he needs to apologize publicly, and he did so one day later, saying that he didn't mean that and that he's learning Kazakh and he will try to increase the use of Kazakh language in his services. And I think the most recent news was that police department of Almaty has started checking his statements regarding Kazakh language. So we don't know where it will turn. President Tokayev last week said that it is unacceptable to turn language and inter-ethnic relations into a political tool. So, there's been a lot of heated discussions about this in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, the situation in Kazakhstan is quite staggering. This outpouring of public anger over a claim by an ordinary person is just mind-boggling. There have been such statements in the previous years, but why now? Why is it that the statement has caused so much anger now?
I think it depends on the current geopolitical context, because even though such similar cases have happened before in Kazakhstan, right now it is a much more sensitive issue given Russia's actions in Ukraine and the whole developments around national identity, language, being like a former colonies, you know. And now I know, at least in Kazakhstan, a lot of young people started to use Kazakh language more, even if they don't speak much of it. A lot of people started to go to different language clubs organized by volunteers to practice their speaking skills. And this has been actually happening before, I would say since 2014. But right now it was like escalated and accelerated. I think that's why we see such a heated discussion about this.
You know, these kind of heated discussions are happening in Kyrgyzstan as well. We have a parliament which is disgruntled over government's program for advancing Kyrgyz language use across the country. We have deputies of parliament regularly criticizing members of the government for poor knowledge of Kyrgyz and for making their reports in Russian language. So we have a similar case. And the thing is, Kyrgyzstan has two camps of thought, or two political groups. The first group thinks that the government has not done enough to promote Kyrgyz language as a state language. And the second school of thought thinks that Kyrgyzstan is a multi-ethnic country where all languages should receive support. So over the past several years, debates, the clashes, the verbal clashes among these two groups have intensified. And I think that you're right, with the recent political situation in Russia and Ukraine and the arrival of so many Russians into the region, language issues have become very much pronounced across the region, particularly in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, where Russian speakers make up a significant segment of the populations.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think one of the takeaways from this, for me at least, that Kazakh language is being used more and more by civil society and by youth, and they're trying to develop it despite official kind of reaction and resistance to turn language into a political issue. And also another key takeaway would be that there's still a gap between what authorities think and what society is doing. Because I think, yeah, obviously authorities are very much aware of the geopolitical context and they're trying to not turn indeed the language into a political issue, fearing Russia's reaction. But they also should notice how society has been changing all these years and how this change has accelerated in the past year, let's say, and that people will not accept the official line anymore, and they will try to push their own agenda more and more. And eventually, if it's going to be ignored by officials, I'm afraid this might turn into another kind of protest or some kind of unrest.
Yeah, let's now move to the second topic, which is the border delimitation process in the Central Asian republics. I remember growing up in the post-Soviet period, and I remember the Fergana Valley being a region where there were borders which were largely porous and unguarded. But then with the rise in religious insurgency in the early 2000s, things began to change and borders became tighter. Governments began to demarcate the borders. And so I've personally seen how these stringent measures had negative economic and social ramifications on ordinary people. So there have been some progress with borders over the past few years. We have this Kyrgyz-Uzbek Commission that has demarcated almost 100% of their 1,375 kilometer of their mutual border. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, however, have had less progress. They share a 971 kilometer frontier, and less than half of that has been demarcated, and more than 70 land parcels remain kind of problematic. Among the toughest dilemmas for the Tajik and Kyrgyz negotiators are the presence of Tajik enclaves on the Kyrgyz territory. And then we have these Soviet-era border maps printed at the time when border delimitation wasn't even an issue. And these maps create additional hurdles for the process. So, and of course, the unresolved border problems have caused tensions in the region for many years. There were shootings, there was some kind of pogroms at the borders. But this year, the stakes seem higher. There were military clashes between the Kyrgyz and Tajik border troops that led to the loss of so many lives. More than 100 people died across the border. The conflict also displaced tens of thousands of people, creating a regional humanitarian crisis. And then the Kyrgyz-Uzbek border delimitation promised that it would become more of a peaceful thing, and then there were hopes that it would be resolved by the end of this year. But the secretive manner in which the Kyrgyz authorities handled the process caused public outcry. Community protests have erupted in various parts of the country in October after it emerged that Kyrgyz authorities were planning to cede some parts and also strategically located Kempirabad water reservoir to Uzbekistan. And more than 20 civil society activists who have spearheaded the protest movement over the water reservoir have been jailed in connection with what the authorities call a plot to organize a mass unrest. And Igerim, you probably heard about that, and maybe you could add some things about what's happening.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's been a very disturbing news about Kyrgyzstan and its decline in democracy, because to me, Kyrgyzstan was like a much more democratic country than Kazakhstan. And I've been surprised to learn that last week there have been dozens of civil society activists jailed, arrested, and that it was all happening amid a crackdown on independent media. The Radio Free Europe, US-funded media outlet, has been blocked in Kyrgyzstan for 2 months now by court. And before that, there were some lawmakers writing letters that it needs to be closed, together with other independent media outlets like Kaktus and Klop. I mean, I've personally been in a Klop office, and I've always been surprised how many topics Kyrgyz independent media outlets can cover. And right now I see that it's becoming more restrictive.
So I think that the reason why the border tensions become more vicious and deadly has to do with this overall military buildup and the lack of peace-building grassroots organizations in the region. But in the case of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, there are concerns that the Kyrgyz authorities are rushing the timetable for border delimitation because they're under pressure from Uzbekistan. And then there is a second thought that actually the Kyrgyz government is trying to push through the border deal because President Mirziyoyev is going to arrive to visit Bishkek, so they want to settle this issue. So whatever the case, I think that this rushed and secretive manner is causing more problems than it actually solves. I've talked to ordinary people in Jalalabad, where this water reservoir is located. The thing is, people there, they're not opposed to this border deal with Uzbekistan, and they're not actually opposed to the transfer of the water reservoir to Uzbekistan. What they're opposed to is clearly this rushed and secretive manner in which this whole thing is happening, and also they're opposed to this land transfer, which is located closer to the water reservoir. This land is arable, and it's really kind of more fertile, and many Jalalabad residents have been using it, so that's what they're opposed to. And I think that the arrest of civil society activists in Kyrgyzstan has aggravated the tensions.
In this episode, we have an exclusive interview of our Central Asia editor Peter Leonard with Nurbek Bekmurzaev, a researcher and writer on radicalization and violent extremist groups. They've been talking about combating radicalism in Kyrgyzstan by teaching religious history in schools and what issues it might have.
I'm here today with Nurbek Bekmurzaev, a freelance writer who's written for Eurasianet on the topic of religious education in Kyrgyzstan. So, Nurbek, just to get started, could you explain to us the article that you wrote for our website recently and how you had the idea of covering the topic?
The article that you mentioned, Peter, is about the introduction of a new course, of a new subject at schools called The History of Development of Religions. It was introduced starting from this school year to ninth graders. There was a presidential decree to introduce the subject in June, and then after 2.5 months, the materials were half ready, and then the course was introduced. I've been following this topic for some time now, because the history of this subject dates back to 2014, and there were several pilot projects on this subject, and I was waiting how it would in what form and shape, with what content it would finally come to schools and hit the students, actual students.
So I mean, the idea of teaching religion in schools is not exactly new, but my understanding from your reporting is that part of the idea of this course is not only so people can learn about religion itself, but that they should also be kind of receiving some kind of moral instruction from this course? I mean, is that your understanding as well?
Yes, and I think that what you allude to here is that it's not just, you know, a secular study of religion as a history subject, but it also supposed to be sort of a guiding subject for school children, and it falls in line with several presidential decrees since Sadr Japar came to power on, you know, preserving national tradition, on upbringing, like, you know, this morals among youth and stuff like that. And if you look at how this course has been basically on hold for so many years, for 8 years, and then it came out right after those presidential decrees, it's more than just like a secular study of religion.
In its previous incarnation, in the pilot project, the course was a much broader look at religions in general, not just Islam. So could you just talk us a little bit through what the course was meant to look like before and what it has ended up looking like now?
The initial course had a different name, History of Religious Culture. It had a more secular approach to the study of religion. It would be more historical, scientific. In the development of the religious course, it was mainly academic people, people with academic background, people with religious studies background, without any, you know, like clear leaning towards any of the religions. That was the main difference, and whereas the current form, I think a very clear bias towards Islam, and as I have mentioned in the article, you know, the majority of people who are behind this course are religious clerks themselves, religious clergy. When I talked to the authors of the previous textbook, they mentioned that they face this resistance from the religious community from the early outset, which argued basically that, you know, we are all Muslims. 80-90% of Kyrgyzstan people are Muslim. The majority of people practice Islam. And so why should they study religions outside of Islam? And also those religions that Islam condemns, you know, like Zoroastrianism, paganism, all those things that that are forbidden religions. And maybe that was one of the reasons, I assume, why the religious course was never at schools, whereas in the current form we see that maybe it had a, you know, like a more lobby from the religious community, and they were able to push it in a very different format.
Anyway, nevertheless, despite the misgivings of education experts, this course is going ahead, and as you've told us in the article, not just in the ninth grade as currently the case, but it'll be rolled out to other grades as well. So I guess the question that kind of naturally flows from that is, this is a new subject and there are going to have to be teachers actually teaching this subject in schools. Does the Kyrgyz education system have enough teachers to actually teach the course that they've now kind of developed?
So what the minister has decided to do is to basically make history teachers to teach this course, and also enroll theologians, additional theologians, to teach this course. And at the moment, the 90% of all teachers who will teach this course are actual history teachers, and around 10%, 200-something teachers, will be theologians. And there are also questions like to what it can potentially lead. If will theologians be able to be objective and restrain themselves from advocating for one religion or the other? And to be frank, theologians in Kyrgyzstan are theologians on Islam. So there are concerns that this may lead to some sort of, you know, propaganda.
One of the maybe stated or unstated aims of the course is to prevent the spread of extremist or radical ideas, religious ideas. From what you've heard from people in the kind of education sector, from experts, do you feel like the course as it's currently designed really effectively pursues that goal?
if you look at the presidential decree, the rise of radicalization and extremism is mentioned as a reason for introducing this course, given how the state has treated the issue of extremism, given how they have exaggerated over the last many years, that's one of the aims. And I suppose that through the study of religion, students are supposed to understand more about religion and they can withstand possible recruitment attempts. It's just so unfounded, in my opinion. If you take a look at, you know, Muslim countries where knowledge of religion is instilled from a young age at schools, in families, where people speak Arabic, actually, you know, and practice religion and know more about religion, it hasn't stopped them from becoming radicalized. Because the issue is misidentified. The issue is not that people... we don't have, you know, like large radicalization of people, because introducing this subject at schools and saying it will prevent radicalization is like, you know, going hunting and then shooting into the sky and hoping it will eventually hit a bird, or shooting into like a dark forest and saying it's going to hit a deer or something. The issue is misdiagnosed and consequently is mistreated. It's being mistreated. Radicalization doesn't happen because people don't know about religion. There are so many different ways and so many different avenues people become radicals or extremists or terrorists or whatsoever. There is very little data to support that introducing this course at schools will help prevent radicalization in any significant way.
This has been Eurasia Chat podcast with your hosts Algirim Toluhanova and Alisher Hamidov. Subscribe at Eurasianet, Apple Music, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in to our next episode.